This is Eric.
I just jumped on, yeah.
Hiya.
Hey.
Hiya.
Yeah, I was just about to instant message you to find out. I just went back and listened to the Oklahoma podcast that you had discussed about. And I'm for the life of me trying to see from your perspective why you would take such an offense to pointing out what I felt like was an interesting inconsistency. Perhaps I came across in totally the wrong way, and that was not my desire at all. And if it came across personally offensive to you as an individual, man, I owe you an apology. My desire was to speak strictly about the argument and the things that were said.
Okay. Let me first bring you up to speed. We're actually recording a podcast called Skeptical Extra, which is we're going to put on. So I don't know if you want to stay on or do you want to give me a call later?
Okay. It's somebody invited me into this, so I'm not sure.
That was me. That was me.
Okay.
That's just, you know. Okay, where we are with that is the criticisms that you were making were entirely valid. Okay, they were entirely valid based on the content of the first debate. So my hands are to that. But as I said to you during our discussions before the recording of the third debate, I very much went into that first debate with about 3 weeks' notice. My original debate was going to be against Amy or Ewing on the historicity of, I think, the nativity. So when I was doing that first debate, I was very much responding intuitively. And I've said this before. I've said this also in the second debate. So your criticisms are perfectly valid based simply on the content of that first debate. They're not valid when you then take into account what was said in the second debate and also in the third debate. And that was what was annoying me. I think that if you're just going to take the first debate and say, okay, that's all that happened, then your comments are fair. But two other debates have happened since then, and particularly the second debate where I said, okay, I was reacting intuitively. I've had a bit more time to think about things like the laws of logic and where all of that comes from. And particularly when you were giving that example – or you were quoting what Cy was saying to me, where he was trying to demonstrate that I'd managed to enter into a self-contradiction, whether I said yes or whether I said no. Now, when I was in the second debate and also in the third debate, I did point out that there are circumstances in paraconsistent logic and also in diethylism where it is possible that the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold. In which case, the law of non-contradiction isn't absolute, but in most circumstances, it does hold. Now, I'm quite happy with that, but that sort of didn't really come across. And Cy is aware of it, and it's explicitly stated in the second debate, which is why I did the transcript.
My problem, Paul, is that even in the third debate, you continued to deny certain laws. So to say that, you know, I accepted.
Hang on a second. I'll call up. Let me just get hold of the transcript of the third debate because I've got that. Whereabouts are you saying that I did that?
Well, throughout the entire thing, as he asked you questions in his first 15 minutes of questioning you. And by the way, when we release this, our goal is to release all three together so people will see the progression. And I understand you saying you've moved from a soft atheist to a hard atheist. Yeah. That's a point that I wanted to take into consideration and ask why. And we do that later in a show afterwards when we're critiquing the debate. Ask the question, why is it that you've moved from a soft atheist to a hard atheist? And then the other thing is how you continued to deny absolute laws of logic, absolute, you know, thinking, absolute morality. There were several things that, you know, you assumed, but then you denied.
Whereabouts? Because I've got the transcript in front of me, and I'm looking at the first 15 minutes block. Whereabouts have I done that?
I don't have the pleasure of having a transcript in front of me, but I'd be more than happy to look through it. The debate a couple times since then via video.
Yeah. My understanding is that wherever I've engaged in a query, just trying to see where. Well,
then I would ask you now: do you hold to the laws of logic as absolute?
Which ones?
Okay, the law of non. It's a. I mean, to me,
well, I've already explained the law of non-contradiction. I've given you paraconsistent logic and diethylism, which provide exceptions to the concept that they can be absolute. Now you can actually go and look those up. Those concepts are in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. What I'm asking, but basically, you're saying, okay, there are times when the law of non-contradiction does not apply.
Yeah, they may only be rare. They may only be kind of like a little speck.
How do we know? How do we know when they apply and when they don't apply? How do we know they can't apply right now to this conversation? And I can say exactly what Cy said in the first debate and say, oh, so you do believe in the law of non-contradiction? Absolutely.
No, why would I not be able to say this? I believe in that I can accept the law of non-contradiction 99.9999% of the time. But I'm also aware that there is that tiny, tiny, tiny little fraction of the time where it doesn't, and that's where diethylism and paraconsistent logic comes in. And you only need that little bit, and it's not absolute.
Well, then I would say this is one of those, and you do believe it. This is one of those 0.0001% of the time, and you actually do believe it.
No, it would be the 0.0001 would be the times when the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold.
Right, and I'm saying
99.99% of the time, I do. And right now is one of those times. I'm quite happy to say right now, Eric, you and I, we agree there is a law of non-contradiction.
Okay, and if we really agreed on that, then we would go straight into how do we account for that. However, I could easily, in an argument, if I was arguing logically with you, I would say, okay, how do you know this isn't one of the 0.0001% of the time? I mean, you see the flaw in logic. You see the problem that we have here.
No.
Okay, so I'm going to say, hey, Paul, this is actually one of those 0.001% of the time. If you disagree with me, well, that's fine because this is one of those times, and so we're both right. Are we both right here or no?
You would need to justify it being one of those times.
No, not according to your worldview. You don't.
Not at all. If it's holding true for 99.999% of the time, I think I'm quite well justified to say that this is one of those occasions where the law of non-contradiction does hold.
Okay, then where did those laws come from? How does a material world create an immaterial law?
Doesn't need to. They can be. There's all sorts of groundings for the laws of logic.
Yeah, I'm asking for how do we account for those? In other words, your worldview would state that there is no supernatural, there is nothing outside of matter. Am I misstating that? Misstating your worldview?
This is not your fault, Eric, but can you not see the problem with advocating presuppositional apologetics like this?
Well, I see the power of it because I could go
to a philosopher like A.C. Grayling or Stephen Law, and I could say, okay, I've got these guys, they're coming along saying, if I can't account for the laws of logic, then I must believe in God. And they'll say, okay, here you go. Here's 10 books. There you go. There's your grounding of logic. Now, I can, you know, read all the way through those 10 books and say, okay, here's your argument. There you go. I don't need God.
Yeah,
which is what you're basically saying to me. I don't have that argument down pat. Therefore, I am in denial of a God I know exists. And to me, that's nonsense.
Well, I realize that the Bible tells us that's because you haven't repented. And that's where my... Honestly, I'm going, okay, God, can you use me to humbly say, Paul, the reason you don't see this, and I'm not trying to be rude, I really am not, Paul, is because you need to repent of sin and trust in Christ. Without repentance, you're not going to see the truth.
Okay, I'll give you one grounding off the top of my head, okay? Let's look at Whitmer. Now, Whitmer is a philosopher, and he said, okay, if you get this silly argument coming your way, just say that logic is properly basic.
Probably basic?
Properly basic.
Oh, yeah, and now what I'm asking is, how do we account for it? In other words,
of the universe.
And I feel like you're avoiding this question
there you go. I give you a philosophically valid answer, and you don't accept it. Valid answer to say it's a properly basic attribute of the universe.
Okay. Where did it come from? Because it's not made out of matter.
It exists as a facet of the universe. So therefore,
does it evolve? Does it change?
Does what?
Does logic change?
Now, this is the question that I asked Cy. What do you mean by that question?
Can it change?
What, can logic, the whole field, change?
Yeah, the entire field. Can any law of life, is it man-made? Did man make it up?
So you're saying, can any facet of the field of thought that we call logic change? The answer is yes.
And I'm not talking about our understanding of it. I'm talking about the actual laws that are, you know, what I would call unchanging. Can an unchanging, immaterial, universal law come from a material world that is always changing, that at one point was not universal?
What? I can see what you're trying to do. What you're trying to say is, okay, well, no, I'm actually struggling with what you're trying to do. I'm saying that the laws of logic can be properly basic as an attribute of the existence of the universe.
Okay, now we've got to take that worldview and compare it to, if you're really going to hold to that, and that would have been really nice if you would have held to that in the debate. In the debate, you wouldn't hold to any worldview. You were saying, well, it could be because of this, or it could be because of this, and that's what we kept
doing. Stephen Law does that. When Stephen Law was arguing with Cy ten Bruggengate, he put up four explanations to ground the laws of logic. Four. And I don't even have to alter any of them.
And does that actually make sense to you, Paul? Okay, you're going to say, hey, it could be any one of these theories. It could be one of those.
Yeah.
I don't believe in any of them.
I don't have to believe in any of them. I gave you the example of the pagan deity being used to ground the laws of logic. And I said to you, for the purposes of arguing the case, I don't actually have to hold that view. Which is exactly the same as what Stephen Law was done when he was putting forward his four groundings of the laws of logic. He said,
"Okay, Then I'm going to ask Paul, what is your view? Because it seems to me that you keep saying it could be one of these over there, but I don't have to hold any of them."
Now this goes back to our pre-debate negotiations. Now I stepped away from this very deliberately because you asked me not to go into it. I'll go into it now. In order to argue presuppositional apologetics in the way that you're doing, it's essential for the apologist to pin down their opponent to one particular worldview. And you have to ask why. Why is it that you need to do that? Okay, I'll take it forward so you can see where I'm going with this. It's essential in a similar, not similar because that's insulting, it's essential in another form of apologetic that's used by Scientologists to identify what the person's worldview is and then to attack it with the view that once you've attacked it, you then only leave them with one possible alternative, which is the one that you present as being true. And that is what a cult does. And that I would have raised in the third debate had you gone down this road. And there were a couple of times you came really, really close to it. That's the first point. The second point is that you're advocating what's called the last man standing fallacy. It's called the disjunctive syllogism, which is where you present a range of choices that range of choices is fixed. So it could be choices A, B, C, D, and E. And you then say, okay, one of those five choices must be true. And you then go through the other four choices and say, it's not A, it's not B, it's not D, C, it's not D. Therefore, it must be E. And that's fallacious.
No, what's fallacious, Paul, is that you don't believe that there is any truth. You can't even say that's fallacious, because to say that's fallacious is means that there is a standard by which we can judge what is fallacious.
No. Let's stick to the argument that we're dealing with, which is the disjunctive syllogism. You're actually saying that we have a range of worldviews, of which mine forms one and of which Christianity forms another. And within that range of worldviews, one must be true. And I'm saying that that is fallacious.
Now, that is misrepresenting the argument, to be honest with you, Paul, because the presuppositional argument is not saying that at all.
I think I could probably quote you Banson doing that.
Well, let me explain then. The presuppositional argument says without God we can't have knowledge. It doesn't say, look at all these worldviews.
Which God?
The God of the Bible.
Hello, gentlemen. How you doing? It's Cy.
Hey, Cy's here.
Paul, you banned me from your blog. What happened there?
You banned me from your Facebook page.
Yeah, but I warned you. I said that my Facebook page was only to inform people of my activities, not for you to inform people of yours.
Well,
I got defriended from Facebook by you, Paul. I actually sent you a friend request back. I was like, what happened here?
Well, as I say, I was really unimpressed, guys, with the Oklahoma podcast.
We talked for a total of 2 minutes, and I brought up one point that I think you would still hold to.
Whoa.
You don't hold to it.
You did not. You brought up, okay, you went through this whole self-contradictory nonsense, and then you did, I think, two piss-take impersonations as well of my accent.
That wasn't me, that was Cy, so you can defriend him, but I'd like to be your friend.
I just thought that based on the courtesy that took place in the recording of that third debate, that what I heard in that podcast was unnecessary. I actually came out of that third debate thinking, Eric Hovind, I've heard a lot about you. You're a man with baggage. But I thought, this bloke is a geezer. Which, in English, that means you're quite a good guy, yeah? I was impressed with you at the end of that, because I thought you've handled this as evenly as I could have expected.
And that was my job as a moderator, Paul. That was my job to do that. But it doesn't mean that I don't hold to a worldview. So it sounds like you're saying, hey, Eric, when you didn't hold to a worldview, I liked you. But if you're going to hold to a worldview, I don't like you.
No, what I'm saying to you is that if you're going to simply quote from the first debate without taking into account what subsequently took place in the second and third debate, and then you somebody chucks in two piss-take impersonations, hey, guys, do you blame me for getting a little bit pissed?
Well, I think it's very odd, Paul, that you seem to get upset when people talk about the first debate and you want them to talk about the other one.
No,
but why do we have to consider that you want us to talk about the other debates when the first one had a huge impact? It was in the top 9 of the top 10 downloads on Justin's show for about 8 months. I mean, that had a huge impact. So, of course, people are going to talk about that.
You can spread the word. I don't
really. Hey, and as far as the accent goes, come on, have a sense of humor. It's a joke.
That didn't come. No, there's a joke, and then there's a joke. That wasn't a joke.
I thought it was pretty funny.
I impersonate Paul Taylor, and he works for me. So, in all honestly, Paul, it was the accent was only in jest. But it gets me back to the real point of it: is what I said inaccurate? Do you believe, you know? And it gets back to the argument, the presuppositional argument. Did I present anything that was inaccurate of what you said? Because you're kind of making the statement here.
No,
that
I'm making the statement that you misrepresented my position on logic, which has developed over the second and third debates.
And so your position on logic, as you just explained to me a few minutes ago, is that 99.999% of the time those laws apply, but yeah, there's a 0.001% when they don't.
Yeah.
But you won't let me contradict you on that. You won't let me say that the 0.001 is applying right now.
No, because I don't know enough about diethylism to be able to argue the point with you when it does and does not apply.
The problem is, Paul, if diethylism contradicts the law of non-contradiction, then it doesn't.
No. Do you actually understand diethylism?
Yeah, I looked into it, Paul, and if it invalidates the law of non-contradiction, then it doesn't.
Have you actually addressed this with the professors of logic who've investigated it? Because I'd be interested to hear you do that. Well, don't you think you should before you go rubbishing it?
No, they're saying that contradictory statements can both be true on some occasions. And I'm saying if that's the case, then it's also not
true. That's what I've just been saying. That is exactly what I've just been saying. They can be both true and false.
That's right. And if that's the case, then they can't be.
On some occasions.
And if that's the case, Paul, then they can't be. That's what I'm saying.
Well, why?
Well, I think what we're trying to get across and what we're trying to get you to see, which I told you is not going to happen until you repent, the validity, the truth of an argument. How can you say?
You both just proved the point that the laws of logic, the law of non-contradiction, is not an absolute.
Then it is, Paul.
I don't know what else to do, do I? It's just brilliant.
No, if you're saying it's not absolute,
if you want to keep it.
Hey, I haven't met the other hosts of your show here yet, Paul and Paul. How you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks. We're having fun listening to this.
Indeed, yes.
Are you guys also having a hard time seeing that if the law of non-contradiction does not always apply, then it does?
I think we're arguing semantics and not concepts.
Let
me just interrupt, because I think that what you need to realize in terms of your methodology of trying to apply the presuppositional apologetic, you need to realize that, okay, you're trying to hammer away at me. Come on, you're being self-refuting. You're in denial. You're contradicting yourself. I'm quite happy with my understanding that diethylism exists. I don't know enough about it to be able to sit here and argue the toss with you about when it does apply, when it doesn't apply. I'm quite happy that as a philosophical theory, it's there. And because of that, one cannot say that the law of non-contradiction is an absolute. I'm quite happy that it applies 99.999 whatever percent of the time.
Okay.
No, because then you are literally trying to engage in semantics, aren't you? But
if the law of non-contradiction is not absolute, then it is, and you have no objection to that. That's just the point, Paul. But the thing is, of course, you're happy.
That is misunderstanding diethylism, though, isn't it?
No, it's not.
You don't understand it totally. How can you say that that's misunderstanding it?
Because it's so obvious.
For somebody to say, I don't understand it, but that's not it, is illogical, Paul.
No, Cy has already gone in and explained it to everybody. There are circumstances where the law of non-contradiction does not apply. There are circumstances where it's possible for A and not A to both be true.
That's what the claim is, Paul, but it's a self-refuting claim. That's what I'm saying.
No. When you can get the professors of logic to agree with you, then I'll take you seriously.
Yeah,
you
Paul,
don't have to get the professors of logic to agree with something to make it right. Validity is not based on what the professors say. Truth is
arguing with ad populum, and I don't think there's anybody.
Are either of you professors of logic?
I am not.
No. Where's this expertise coming from that you're able to make such sweeping statements about what their professional opinions have come up with? Because I'm really interested, because if this is true, you guys should be teaching in universities.
Paul, that's the fallacy of the argument ad populum.
No.
Sure it is.
It's the argument from...
It's true because other professors say it's true. But the thing is that diethylism, I actually looked into it, it's a very small field, and I think that it's mostly mocked among people that they can say contradiction can be true.
Field to invalidate absolutism.
Pardon me?
It only needs to be very, very small to invalidate.
But it doesn't, though, Paul. It's very small because it's a ridiculous theory.
And this is based on... what knowledge of logic that you have?
Based on the fact, Paul, that if contradictory statements can both be true, then they can't. It's a ridiculous claim.
And what authority claim are you basing this on? Do you have a degree in maths and logic? A PhD?
Paul, if you're saying that the law of non-contradiction is not absolute, no. Then you're saying that it is. That's what I'm saying, that you can
and
have...
I'm asking you, based on what authority are you making that statement? And so far, you're not providing any. You've got no qualifications in logic. You're not a professor of logic. You've got no degree in maths. So where's this expertise coming from?
Well, Paul, are you saying that I'm incorrect? Where are your degrees in logic and in math? On what basis do you say that I'm incorrect?
I'm basing it on their authority. And I'm interested to see where your authority is coming from. I've got a couple of professors of mathematics and logic who are putting forward a theory, and I'm very interested to hear how you are able to invalidate it.
Because it's self-contradictory. It's self-evidently self-contradictory.
Self-evident to whom?
To everybody.
Well, everybody? Is that absolutely everybody, including those professors?
Yes, Paul, including you.
Well, thanks. That's been a blast.
can I make a statement on this self-contradictory thing? If there's an exception to something being self-contradictory that says that it can be self-contradictory, then it can't be self-contradictory. Then it contradicts itself, so then it can be self-contradictory, which contradicts itself, so it can't be self-contradictory. You've got an infinite regression, and you've got no firm conclusion there.
That's right, and you're talking to Paul.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
You've got it, Paul. That was a very good point. Thank you.
There can be no conclusion on it because it self-contradicts itself. If it self-contradicts itself,
exactly
it can't be
right.
What are you saying?
You're exactly right. That's exactly right. It's a ridiculous claim because it's self-contradictory. There's an infinite regress. Without an absolute standard, you know, it's a ridiculous claim. You're absolutely right. I agree with you.
Is that what you're just saying?
Can I just say that the discussing logic as a thing that was created is
nobody's saying that. I don't think logic was created.
Yeah, how was it created? Who made it?
I think Eric was asking where it came from, who created it.
Well, according to your worldview, but not according to our worldview, it was not created. Logic is a reflection of the way God thinks in our worldview. It was not created.
To me, logic is a methodology. It is a tool that we use to ascertain meaning and truth or probability of truth.
According to your worldview, that's correct. But according to our worldview, it's a reflection of the way God thinks. And we have to be imitators of God.
Yes, agreed. As long as we both agree that that's your interpretation of logic and we have our interpretation of logic. To me,
right.
it's a methodology, it's a tool that I would use to determine
right.
the probable truth of something.
And in the first debate, Paul said that it was subject to man. Do you believe that as well?
We don't change logic. Man uses it as a tool.
Okay, but how do you account for the laws of logic, or logic itself then?
We define it.
Pardon me?
We define it.
We define it. Okay, but do you think it's a characteristic of the universe?
I'd say that's a meaningless phrase. It's like...
Well, did logic apply before men walked the earth?
Did mathematics apply before somebody invented mathematics? What did 2 plus 2 equal?
Well, let me ask you this. Let me put it this way. Could the sun have both existed and could the universe have both existed and not existed at the same time and in the same way before man walked the earth?
I can answer that.
From your point of view, yes. From mine, no.
Why not?
I would tend to hold to the laws of non-self-contradiction, whereas you can bend that and say that something...
No, not at all. I'm saying that the laws of logic are a reflection of God's character, of his nature, the way he thinks. But the thing is, I'm wondering why if logic is subject to man or a tool of man, did it apply before man existed? And you're telling me that it did, and I'm asking why.
No, I didn't say that. I responded with another question about mathematics. Right. What did 2 plus 2 equal?
No, that's not – I asked you if the universe could both,
equal to.
So I asked you if the universe could have both existed and not existed at the same time in the same way.
Let me pick that one. No. Let me pick that
before
one.
Man existed, and you said
it's
no,
it
couldn't.
It's a self-refuting question. Hmm. Asking if the universe could exist and not exist at the same time and in the same way is a self-refuting question.
Why, Paul?
Because time is a function of the universe.
So before man existed...
If you're going to measure, okay, the universe is existing, the universe is not existing, and you're measuring that within a time frame, where are you getting that time frame from?
Okay, let's change
time before man existed.
Could time have existed and not existed at the same time?
That is a ridiculous question.
It sounds just ridiculous.
At an event horizon, Paul. Yes, it could.
Do you believe that there was time before man existed?
Oh, dear.
Was there time before man existed?
Yes.
Okay, there was time before man existed. Now, I'm asking you, in time, prior to man existing, could the universe have both existed and not existed at the same time and in the same way prior to man existing?
You don't know.
No.
You don't know. So it's possible.
I would have to say no.
Based on what? Why not?
Self-contradiction.
Self-contradiction.
Can you define the situation where something exists? Can you define that exact scenario where something does exist and doesn't exist? Can you give a definition or a...
No, I'm saying that it's impossible because I believe in the absolute laws of logic. I'm just wondering why you believe it's impossible.
Okay. I believe it's impossible because it's self-contradictory.
Yeah, okay, but why are self-contradictions not allowed before man came along? Where is this logic that you're talking about before man existed?
I think Paul Baird has already stated that the laws of logic are properly basic, and that's all you need to...
Is it a characteristic of the universe?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Let me ask you this question. Is constant change a characteristic of the universe?
We don't know.
You don't know? You're trying to tell me that you don't know if the universe is changing?
Are you able to see the full extent of the universe to be able to check?
Isn't it getting older? Isn't it like the second law of thermodynamics? Aren't you changing? Aren't the things within this universe changing? Isn't constant change a property of this universe? Are you telling me you don't know that?
No, there is a very simple way of elucidating that question. All you have to do is you have to ask the question, how long can a condition of no change exist?
I just want to get back to my question. Is change a property of the universe?
Let's go for it. This is fun. I'm enjoying myself.
Yes.
Okay, now if change is a property of the universe and unchanging laws that are a property of the universe, how do you reconcile the two? They both can't be properties of the universe according to your worldview.
I've defined logic as a methodology. It's a tool that we use, whereas the universe is a physical thing. Or it's not even a physical thing. It's a collection of objects. The universe is a collection of the objects within it.
And why couldn't contradictions apply then if it's only a tool that man's used? Why couldn't contradictions apply before man existed?
I would say they can't.
Why not? If it's only a tool that man used...
Because the tool works, and the tool says that it can't. You use a tool because it works. I use a hammer to knock in a nail because it works.
In order to determine if something works, first of all, you have to know what the proper function of that thing is, which atheism cannot provide you.
The exception to the rule. You'd have to find another example of something that exists and doesn't exist both at the same time in the same way.
No, I'm saying it's impossible.
You have to be able
because
to
I believe in absolute laws of logic. But Paul, for instance, says that there's exceptions to the absolute laws of logic, so why can that apply to the universe?
I think we agree in the same thing, only for different reasons.
Well, that's right, but you have no reason.
You believe it was constructed.
No, I don't. I don't believe that logic was constructed.
Neither do I.
So it exists. So it is self-existent.
No, it's not self-existent. It's a reflection of the way God thinks.
The property of God. Whereas I'm saying that logic is a behavior of the universe.
A behavior of the human race.
No, the universe.
Of the universe. Okay, and change is also a behavior of the universe, correct?
Generally speaking, yeah.
Okay, so then why doesn't logic change?
They're not mutually exclusive, though, are they? You can have things that don't change and things that do change.
And how do you reconcile the two? How do you know that logic won't start to change?
They don't need to be reconciled.
Yeah.
According to your world, do you have things that change and things that stay the same? What prevents them from switching properties? What prevents the laws of logic from, you know, to start changing, and the laws of, you know, other material things, particulars in this universe that will stop changing? What prevents that in your worldview?
What causes it? What are you saying causes that change?
No, I'm not saying that there is. I'm saying that some things in this universe change, some things stay the same.
It's like saying, why is pi what it is, and why does pi not become the number 4?
Yeah, why?
Pi stays. It stays the way it is because it stays the way it is. It is a proper.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a real good argument, Paul. It stays the way it is because it stays the way it is. Now we're back into our first debate with your vicious circularity.
No, not at all. I am not at all. It's a properly basic constant of the universe.
Yeah, and then there are also things that change. And how do you know that this one won't change?
Because it's a constant.
Yeah.
Would 2 + 2 ever stop
changing? Because it won't change. And that's a viciously circular argument. And that's the problem with your worldview.
No, it's not. It's a constant. It's defined as being a constant.
How do you know
it's
it won't change?
It's an axiom. It's what we begin with.
Are all axioms valid, Paul?
Now, you see, this is what you do. And
you say it's an axiom. I want to know if all axioms are valid.
No, this is what you do. And, again, if you do this in any future debate, should we ever have one, I will roll out the Scientology comparison because you're doing it.
Well, on your blog, Paul, you just said that you won't do any more radio debates.
I will go your methodology.
On your blog, you said you won't do any more radio debates.
No, I'm not doing any more radio debates on Premier Christian Radio, but that's not because of you. Trust me, you're not the cause of me not wanting to do another debate on PCR. David Robertson has that responsibility. No, what we're dealing with, in terms of things being constant, they are constant because that is the property that they've been given within the universe.
But given by whom, Paul?
No, you're saying by the universe existing.
Oh, the universe gave them this property?
Yeah.
So the universe is a personal thing.
The universe exists. No. The universe is whatever it is, and these constants are constants because the universe exists.
Right. And how do you know they won't change?
Because they're constants.
All right. I think we've gone down that road enough.
For the same, can God change?
Paul, do you see this? No, God can't change. He's revealed.
Why not? Is he a constant?
God is a constant. So God is a constant, and constants can't change. Can you not see the self-refutation?
No, God can't change. He's revealed this to us. That's how we know it. And I'm asking how you know it.
Because he says so. Can he change or can't he change?
No, God can change.
Because he's
constant. Because he's constant.
His nature is that he does not change, and he's revealed this to us. That's how I know it. I'm asking how you know that the laws of logic won't change.
How do you know?
And if they can change, on what basis do you apply them?
How do you know that God doesn't change?
He's revealed that to us such that we can be certain of it.
Well, logic reveals it to us so that we can be certain
of
it.
Okay. Are you telling me that logic reveals?
Well, I would strongly dispute that God reveals.
Logic reveals?
I would strongly dispute that God reveals.
I realize that because you're an unbeliever, but tell me how logic reveals.
I'm using your argument against you. You're saying that God is a constant, and then you're saying that...
I'm saying God is a personal being that can reveal. Are you saying that logic can reveal? That's what you just said 2 minutes ago.
Logic can reveal. It reveals truth.
A personal being.
Okay, give me an example of logic revealing, please. How do you know that A cannot be both A and not A at the same time and in the same way 2 seconds from now? How did logic reveal that to you?
I'll use a different example. We're talking about revealing knowledge. If you look at Galileo, how he worked out the rules of gravity, he did that through a logical exercise. He didn't do that through experimenting. He did it through a logical thought experiment. So their logic worked, and he revealed new knowledge about gravity that didn't exist before. It contradicted existing knowledge.
Are you trying to tell me that logic is derived by testing?
No, he didn't test it. That's the whole point. He derived the principles without testing. It was tested later on and verified.
How do you verify logic?
By testing.
Do you use logic in this verification process?
Not necessarily. It's evidential. It's evidential.
Okay, can you give me an example of how you verify logic without using logic? And what do you use then?
Evidence.
And do you use logic when you use this evidence? Are you trying to say that evidence doesn't require logic?
Well, if you look at quantum mechanics, it's entirely illogical.
I would disagree with that, by the way.
Galileo worked out the principles of gravity.
Based on what, sir? What qualifications have you got in quantum theory?
What are you talking about qualifications again?
Because you seem to be an expert in logic.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you.
Well, I'm just wondering which university hands out these degrees, and so quickly as well, it would seem.
Since when do you have to go to
university? Everything.
Since when do you have to go to university to get knowledge?
Well, you don't, because I've got a doctor of theology and I bought it for $95.
Yeah, so that's true.
Don't trust any of these damn creationist professors.
You guys are making a real good time.
I'm just trying to... Well, what?
I just said you guys are making a real good point.
What we're trying to say?
I said you're making a very good point for yourself. You're showing the illogical inconsistencies of your worldview, yet how you borrow from our worldview in order to be consistent and logical.
No, not at all, Eric. Not at all.
Because we believe in constraints. Because we believe in constants.
No basis for that belief.
What we're actually seeing is...
But you believe in the constants because he's told you.
That's right. And why do you believe in them?
But that is not logic. It's something absolutely true because somebody tells you it's so.
Right. Okay, why do you believe things to be absolutely true?
I don't.
Oh, okay. Is that absolutely true that you don't believe things to be absolutely true?
Absolutely.
Well, there we go.
I don't believe in...
No, because that's what you do, Si. You're confusing, deliberately conflating absolutely as a word being used for emphasis, and absolutely meaning utterly unchangeable.
Well, you dodged my other question earlier, Paul. Are all axioms valid?
Hey, which Paul? We're all called Paul.
Paul Baird. I asked Paul Baird earlier if all axioms were valid.
It's gone very quiet.
Yeah, that's usually what happens when I ask Paul these questions.
Oh, I can see two Pauls. Oh, right. I don't know what happened there.
Well, we're all back now, I think.
I don't think Eric's back yet.
Okay, we're all back.
This is fun. Yeah, there he comes. This is fun.
Are we still recording?
We are, yes.
I see you did a debate or interview with Justin Schreiber.
Yeah, I did this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got that up on the net already.
Oh, excellent. I wasn't sure who was going to post that.
Yeah.
It says Sheba, actually.
Sheba.
Yeah.
Sheba would be the...
Yeah, maybe wrong.
Situation.
If there is right and wrong.
You're back. Guys, I enjoy these because for me the purpose is not winning, it's having a good old discussion.
You don't enjoy them, Paul. You get your shorts in a knot.
I get my shorts in a knot for a good reason. I did not have my shorts in a knot during the second or the third debate. I got them a little.
You've had your shorts in a knot from the beginning.
No, I haven't. No.
Is that both true and not true at the same time?
I don't know. Is that a diethylist question?
Yeah. And it can't be known absolutely.
Ah, you see, we can play this game. We know the rules.
There's a 0.0001% that he had his shorts in a knot and not in a knot at the same time.
Yeah. What we still haven't, this is why I think that Justin Brierley doesn't want this on PCR again. Because if you're going to have any sort of presuppositional apologetics debate, whether it's between you and me, Si, or whoever.
Actually, Paul, I've done a little bit of research into why he probably doesn't want us on anymore. if that's the case. I've done some research. I talked to a fellow who's quite familiar with the broadcast laws in Britain, and apparently that these type of shows, in order for them to retain their license, they have to be balanced. And the reason that Justin got between us in the second debate so often is because the first one was so unbalanced.
That's cobblers.
Well, that's I understand there's another Christian show that actually broadcasts out of a foreign country so that they can get around these broadcast laws. Yeah. You know, and that makes an awful lot of sense to me, because I was wondering why I was only able to ask you four questions in an hour. And I think that's because they didn't want to see a repeat of the first one and lose their license.
No, that's cool.
I understand it's because some of the debates get a bit technical, and the average listener to that particular program are not.
But people loved the first one.
Well, no, there were posts that were saying that was so far above my head, I just was not interested. No, in terms of the
I haven't seen any posts like that.
I have. Well, I'll go back on if I hadn't deleted my profile. In terms of the broadcast license, what they are not going to do is make the judgment based on one broadcast or even on one debate.
No, no. What I'm saying is that after listening to the first one, they were probably warned. Don't let that happen again. That makes perfect sense because I thought it was kind of weird.
That's complete speculation, this is.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, if you listen to the first one and you listen to the
second one. Have you actually read the IBA complaint that was made about PCR a couple of years ago? It was one that was made in about 2005, and it was across a range of broadcasting, across a range of shows. It wasn't based on one particular show.
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that it was based on our show, Paul, but I'm saying that based on our first show, that they were probably spoken to, saying, don't let something like that happen again, because it wasn't balanced.
Rubbish. That is.
Well, anybody who listens to this podcast, I say listen to the first debate, then listen to the second one, and you might want to ask curiously why I wasn't able to ask Paul more than four questions in over an hour, and you know that is the only explanation so far that's made any sense to me. If you can come up with another one, I'd be happy to hear it.
Possibly because Paul Baird had some good arguments. That's what I imagine.
His good argument prevented me from asking questions, caused the host to get in between when I asked Paul a question. Well, I'm sorry. I don't mind.
I think that Justin was aware that if we got into – as we've already done, and people who listen to this podcast will be able to judge – once you get into this discussion of logic, to you, it's quite a fundamental thing, and I can appreciate that. To the average listener, it's as dull as dishwater. It's like watching paint dry.
Well,
because
Paul,
they sort of think, who cares?
The first debate was wildly popular. It was number 9 in the top 10 downloads.
Yeah, and that was because Dr. James White leapt on a mistake that I made.
See, I don't buy that, because up until that point, James White had been on the show twice, and none of his encounters were on the top 10, and he advertised those on his show. So I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think that is very popular because of the form of argumentation that people never heard before.
I don't think so.
Well, Justin's
comment to me was that was the reason, and it is interesting that if it was as popular as it was, why did it not stay in the top 10?
That's because he had people like Rob Bell on, who's really famous over here for his recent book, and it's because they had people who actually who are famous on the show, and that's why it got bumped out. Because fact is, both of us are nobodies. The fact that it was on the top 10 for any amount of time, for 8 months or whatever it was, you know, I thought that was amazing.
No, I think it was on that long because that's how long it took Justin to update the stats. He doesn't do them that frequently.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, as a piece of helpful advice, if you're going to go hammer and tongs at logic, let's say you've actually got a point, okay, and let's say that all of us three Pauls are utterly wrong and you're utterly right, and you're going at this hammer and tongs, you're going to bore the pants off people. Which I think is what happened.
I'm not here to entertain people. I'm here to speak the truth. But that's one thing that Eric and I are working at. We're working at getting this argument to the level that the average person can understand it, because. Because you're right, logic can be a difficult topic, and we're trying to get this to a level that the average person understand it.
Dull. It's like going out onto the street corner and trying to preach calculus.
If you look at my website, Paul, under the multimedia page, I actually did go out on the street corner, and I didn't use the laws of logic per se in my discussion. That's the thing about presuppositionalism. It doesn't necessarily have to get into the finer points of logic. It has to do with the fact that God certainly exists. Everybody knows that he exists, and all arguments against God assume that he exists.
Have you seen any other street preachers? Because we see quite a few. And to be honest, you were a street preacher. You were arguing with a bystander. We see this stuff a lot. And right. You were, quite honestly, no different in what you were trying to say.
I thought he was a lot different, and the academy that he was at thought it was a lot different. And it really, it's because it gets down to this point that we keep bouncing around and avoiding, which is, how do we account for these laws? Paul Baird, you say they're a property of the universe. Psy has, I believe, defeated that argument by saying...
How? Do it again, Sly. I want to see you do this.
You're saying that these laws, which are unchanging, are a property of the universe, but change is also a property of the universe, and you cannot reconcile the two.
See, now, that why is that a defeater?
So
you're saying that within a changing universe, you can have things that don't change.
Well, okay, on what basis do you assume that the laws won't change if change is a property of the universe?
But change and non-change can both be properties of the universe.
Okay, how do you know that they won't switch?
You're saying they're mutually exclusive. On what basis?
Yes. Yes.
On what basis?
Because they're opposites, Paul.
That's the very nature of it.
No. What you're saying is either the universe is changing or the universe is unchanging. But the universe, yeah, it's like saying, yeah, this is where I'm sort of heading with this. Are you saying that entropy, things will always move from an ordered state to a disordered state, is true?
I'm saying that there are things in this universe that change and things that don't change, and I can reconcile that with what controls the universe. But I'm saying that you cannot.
The law of entropy says that things will move from an ordered to a disordered state.
Even the laws of logic, Paul?
No. See, there you go. You're diverting. Let me finish my point.
All right.
What I'm saying to you is, okay, we have the law of entropy that generally says things will move from an ordered to a disordered state. But within that, you can still have things that move from a disordered to an ordered state. That's how this planet got formed.
And the thing is, you're talking about both things that change. But you're also saying that there are things that don't change, and I'm wondering how you reconcile them. In a universe where one of its constituents is change, how do you reconcile things that do not change?
I don't need to.
On what basis do you assume that they won't change 2 seconds from now?
I don't need to. You're sort of saying, hey, we've got one property of the universe and another property of the universe. Why can the universe not have both?
Because they're mutually exclusive, Paul.
No, they're not.
No, they're not.
I'm saying that it can have both with a God that controls both of them. With a God that controls both of them and keeps them uniform.
This is the parlor trick.
Keeps the things that change changing and keeps the things that are uniform uniform.
I'm glad Paul Jenkins was on to spot that, because that will stay on and people will be able to say, right, we get the point.
No, I'm just wondering if there are things that don't change, on what basis do you assume that they won't change? It's a very simple question.
And we've already said they're constants.
I know, but you're saying they won't change because they won't change. And if you don't see a problem with that argument, then there's no sense continuing with it.
They're a constant.
Suppose I said that the reason that they don't change is by the impossibility of the contrary.
Yeah, and then I would say to you, how do you know that the contrary is impossible?
Same applies to God.
No, because he's revealed to us that the contrary is impossible. That's the difference.
Because he's told you. That's not a good argument.
How do you know that?
Somebody's told you so.
How do you know that? Are you saying that God could not do that?
God couldn't change.
Are you saying that God could not reveal things to us such that we can know them for certain?
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, how do you know that for certain?
Because you've used the word certain.
Are you saying that certainty is impossible, Paul?
I'm saying within the sentence that you've used, yes.
Okay, and how are you certain of that?
Because there are other explanations that are possible.
And now we get back to the argument about money. You're saying that there can be no real money because there's counterfeits. And that's a very silly argument, and I'm surprised that you stick with that.
You got absolutely flattened on that argument. If you want to bring it up again, let's go for it.
Okay, let's bring it up again, Paul. I'm saying.
Don't use currency.
No, I'll use whatever I want.
No, that's fine. I'll bring up the very same argument. I'll have Paul refute it. Paul, are you saying that because there are counterfeits, there's no real money?
What's real money?
Legal tender.
What's legal tender?
Something to be used.
Are you trying to tell me that you don't know what legal tender is?
No.
Is that your refutation of this argument?
I want you to define what legal
tender is. That your...
Yes, it is. I want you to actually define.
That's your refutation that I have to define every word for you?
Yeah, because what you do a lot is you use ambiguous terms.
So legal tender, Paul, is money that is by law allowed to be used in the country where it's issued.
By agreement. By agreement. By people. Okay. It's people who have agreed.
Yeah, whatever. That's fine. Okay, but there is legal tender. Correct. There is such thing as legal tender, correct?
But not universal legal tender.
That's not what I'm saying. That's not the argument. I'm saying there is such thing as legal tender, correct?
And we're saying there's more than one.
Is there such a thing as legal tender, Paul?
Yep.
Paul Baird, is there such a thing as legal tender?
No.
Is there such a thing as legal tender, Paul? Paul Baird. Yes? Is there such a thing as counterfeits, Paul?
Counterfeit what?
Counterfeit money, Paul.
Counterfeit real money.
Counterfeit legal tender.
But it can't be legal tender if it's counterfeit, can it?
That's the whole point, Paul. Thank you. You stated it very clearly, finally.
No, because what you're doing is you're missing the point. What you're saying is there can only be one legal
tender. No, that's not what I'm saying, Paul. I'm just saying
your argument
is that there can be no real money because there are counterfeits. And that's just an asinine argument that you're sticking to it. It's just remarkable.
He hasn't said that at all.
Exactly. Thank you, Paul. What you're doing is twisting the argument, and you are so good at it. And if you do that again in one of our arguments, I will have you for it.
Go back to the debate, Paul, and listen to it. I asked you point blank. I said, are you saying that there can be no real money because there are counterfeits? And you said, yes. Go back to the debate. That's what you said, Paul. Are you retracting that now?
No, I'm just looking at what I said. What I came back to you with was...
I don't care what you came back to me with, Paul. Your argument that there can be no real money because there's counterfeits, and you said yes? Is that your position?
No. What I'm saying is, and this is very different, because what you're doing is you're mangling the English language. Can there be confidence in real money if there is counterfeit?
That's not what I'm asking you, Paul.
No.
We're talking about legal tender. There's legal tender. There is money that is valid. That's legal tender. And now there's also counterfeits. But you're saying because there's counterfeits, there can be no legal tender. And that's your argument with Revelation. You're saying because there's counterfeit revelations, there cannot be a real one. And that's a ridiculous argument.
No, that's not what Paul Baird is saying. That's not at all what he's saying.
Paul Jenkins, you can explain that then. Explain what Paul's saying.
What I'm saying to you is the value or the worth of a real currency depends on the confidence in that currency.
Yeah, that's fine. I have no problem with that, Paul. But that's not what I'm talking about.
Confidence in the currency can be affected by the presence of counterfeits.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that there's no legal tender. It doesn't mean that there's no real money because there's counterfeits. And that's the absurdity of your position.
Can there be real leprechauns? There's lots of fake leprechauns. Can there be real ones?
Yeah, excellent point.
Can there be real leprechauns?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
So how do you know there can be real money?
Because I have senses and I have reasoning that is given to me by God in which I can discern this.
Paul Sinbad makes a very...
I don't believe in leprechauns, but the thing is leprechauns are not a necessary precondition for logic. And if you want to assume that leprechauns are a necessary precondition for logic, make that argument. I'll be happy to debate you on it.
Legal tender isn't a prerequisite for logic.
No, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, are you saying that because there's counterfeits, there can be no legal tender? And that's Paul's argument.
No, it isn't.
Sure it is. Listen to the debate.
No, what I said to you repeatedly, what you were trying to say was that there can only be one legal tender.
I was counteracting your argument that there can be no legal tender because there are counterfeits, that there can be no real revelation because there's counterfeits. That's what I was countering. Now we can get into the revelation itself, but I was just countering your ridiculous claim that there can be no real revelation because there's counterfeits.
And Paul, you're confusing legal tender and an individual state's currency or government's currency.
They are legal tender. Within those countries, they are legal tender.
Oh, so it does exist.
No, we're comparing legal tenders now. Are you saying
If you want to say that you have another deity as your justification, that's a different debate, and we can get into that.
That's what we were debating.
Your refutation of revelation was because there were counterfeits. And I'm saying that you're basically saying that there's no real money because there's counterfeits. Now, I'm saying there is real, that there can be, your answer should have been, yes, there can be real revelations, and we'll talk about that revelation. But you're saying, no, there can't be real revelation because there's counterfeits. Because I asked you, Paul, if it was impossible for the Bible to be what it claimed to be, and you said yes.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, why is that impossible, Paul? Why could not an all-knowing and all-powerful God reveal things to us in a book such that we could be certain of them? Why is that impossible?
Because you can't be certain.
How do you know that, Paul? Are you certain that we can't be certain?
I'm certain that within the context of that sentence, you can't be
certain. So you're not absolutely certain?
You see, this is what you do.
That's right, Paul.
Whenever you deny certainty, Paul,
with a certain claim.
Around the subject, and you're doing it now.
Well,
you're dancing across to another.
I think it's clear for anybody listening that that's not the case, Paul. I'm glad to let the record stand as is.
Well, yeah, because it'll be our record, yours. Where we are is that in terms of revelation, saying that the Bible is a revelation from God, can you be certain that that is the case?
You're saying that it's impossible, Paul. Regardless of my certainty, you're saying that that is impossible, that God cannot reveal himself in a book.
No, you're saying, you missed the words off for certain.
Is it possible? Okay, let's shorten it down then, Paul. Could God reveal himself in a book?
Which book?
Is that possible? Is it impossible for God to reveal himself in a book, Paul? Paul Baird.
I'm going to say yes.
Okay, now we're not talking about certainty. Why isn't it possible for an omnipotent, omniscient being to reveal himself in a book?
How do I know he is those things?
And that's not what I'm asking you, Paul. I'm asking if it's possible.
It is. That's what you're assuming I'm going to accept, and I don't.
If such a being exists, Paul, could he do that?
Well, maybe he could be a leprechaun as well.
Paul, see, now that's the thing, Paul. You don't debate honestly. Because I took out the word certainty.
Honestly,
I took out the word certainty from my question. You still won't answer it because you realize that the answer of the question demolishes your position.
No, it doesn't.
You're saying that it's not impossible for God to exist, but you're saying that it's impossible for this being to reveal himself in a book, which is a ridiculous point.
No. What I said in the annotated transcript was that when I said yes, I should have said no, but I think we were going too fast. So if you're going to ask me, is it impossible for God to exist, I'm going to say no.
Too fast, Paul? That was my first question.
Possible for God to exist, the answer is no.
That was my first question. Oh, are you saying that you answered differently because I went too fast?
Yeah, I'm saying no. If you're going to ask me, is it impossible for the Christian God to exist, my answer is yes.
Okay, and how do you know that, Paul?
Because there are other gods, and the Christian God claims exclusivity.
Sounds pretty ridiculous, Paul.
Not at all. Can you prove those other gods don't exist?
Paul.
You don't even believe in those other gods.
That doesn't matter. We've discussed that previously. I can advance an argument without holding it.
Paul, you're saying that there can be no real money because there's counterfeits. That's what you're saying, Paul. And I'm glad to let the record
I'm
stand.
Saying that there can be no exclusive legal tender. Because there
are other currencies. That's right. That's what you're saying. And how do you know that, Paul? How do you know your reasoning about this is valid?
See, there you go. You're dancing around the subject.
No.
Lost the point.
You're making a knowledge claim, Paul. You're making a knowledge claim.
No, you're dancing
around. What we're saying is that you can't know anything without God. So I want
to
know how you know this.
Dancing around.
I want to know how you know it.
You just got slapped.
How do you know it, Paul?
You keep protesting, Si.
You said you could be wrong about everything you claim to know, and you're making certain knowledge claims.
Dancing, Si.
If you don't see the problem there, Paul, then I can't help you.
I have to put music to this because you're dancing away because you lost.
And now you're making certain knowledge claims when you said that you could be wrong about everything you claim to know, so you can't make certain knowledge claims. You're saying it's impossible for God to exist, and yet you can be wrong about everything. Could you be wrong about that, Paul? Could you be wrong about that it's impossible for God to exist? Could you be wrong about that?
Within my subjective certainty, no.
But
who's dancing?
Could it be wrong, Paul? Subjective certainty, what's that?
That's
your belief system.
I'm aware of.
You're talking about your belief
system.
Welcome
to it.
You're yes. talking about your belief system. You're not talking about knowledge or certainty.
No, excuse me? Is your knowledge the same as mine?
You're not talking about certainty. You're talking about belief.
Is your knowledge the same as mine? Because if your knowledge is not the same as mine, then your knowledge is subjective to you, just as mine is subjective to me.
You said that you can be wrong about everything you claim to know in the debate. That's what you said. You can be wrong about everything that you claim to know. But you also say it's impossible for God to exist. Could you be wrong about that?
Not within my subjective certainty, no.
So there are some things that you can't be wrong about. There's something that you're absolutely certain about.
How are you defining certainty?
You just defined you said you're certain that God does not exist, the God of the Bible.
No. What we're working with is two different definitions of what is certain. As I say, anybody listening to this is going to be absolutely bored.
I did not know there was
certainty, Paul. I'll give you my definition. Certainty is the property of a proposition that it cannot fail to be true. That's certainty.
Is that absolute certainty?
Yes.
Because the word absolute was missing from that definition.
And it cannot fail to be true.
Using that definition within my subjective worldview.
What is relative certainty, Paul? What's relative certainty? There's no such thing as relative certainty. You're talking about a belief system.
How do you know? Are you certain about that?
Yes. I'm absolutely certain. Because I have a worldview that believes in absolute certainty, and you deny it.
This is funny.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny, too.
So you don't understand. We will do. You don't understand the concept of relative certainty, and you don't understand, obviously, the concept of relative morality either. You don't even understand what relativism is.
I hope that there's a lot of people listening to this podcast and listening to Paul talk about relative certainty. Paul, mention that as many times as you can, please. On this podcast, when I'm not a guest, just mention it. Relative certainty. You believe in relative certainty. Please repeat that. Go up to the microphone and talk about that. I appreciate that.
Okay, well, look, on that note, we are coming up to about 10 o'clock, and I think it's probably a good idea to draw this to a close because we could probably go on all night. Could I just ask shut up. Could I just ask, for the sake of the recording, could I ask Eric and Si, do we have your permission to post this as a podcast?
I would say you can have my permission if you post it unedited. You can edit out the pauses, but don't edit out the words that we spoke.
Okay.
Then you have my permission to do that.
Okay. Fine. Is that both of your permission?
Yeah, Eric would say the same thing, and I'm absolutely certain of that, not relatively certain.
Okay, thank you very much,
and
guys.
And Paul, I want to say this, Paul. I mean, we're debating our respective worldviews, but Paul, I do this because I love you, and I realize that when we get into this heated debate,
I know.
I realize it doesn't come across. And I think that, Paul, if we met in person, we would have a laugh. We'd have a really good time. And I think there's no reason for us to be banning each other. And I'll take that ban off my Facebook page if you abide by the rules of it. That, you know, if you want to make comments on it, fine. But I don't want people to post stuff other than my activities. And if there's things that you don't want to post on my blog, that's fine. Just give me a warning. But I think that we can be a lot more cordial about this. That we don't have to be butt heads like this. Is that fair, Paul?
I'll have a think about it.
All right, that's a start.
I want to be your friend too, Paul. And Paul.
It was nice meeting your other two Pauls, and I'm looking forward to hearing this.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you both.
It'll be a blast.
Thanks a lot. All right. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Good night.